Welcome into episode 116 of the Robot Report podcast. I'm your host, Steve Crow, editorial director of the Robot Report. Thank you, folks, for tuning in. As always, really, really appreciate it. Joined, as always, by my partner in crime, Mr. Mike Oitzman. Mike, it was great to see you recently. How you doing, man?
I'm tired, I would say. After a couple of weeks here of a pretty solid travel, I think it's time for a little downtime and relaxation.
Yeah, absolutely. So big show today. Later on, we'll play our interview with Roberta Nelson Shea. She's the Global Technical Compliance Officer at Universal Robots, very well known and adored throughout the robotics industry. Also, one of the winners of the 2023 Joseph F. Engelberger Robotics Awards. She won for the application. She was the application winner for her work over the course of her career and global robotics safety. So we talked to Roberta. She's a great storyteller, as you many of you probably are already aware of that. But some of her stories that you'll hear later on in the program are just tremendous. But congrats to Roberta on that. We'll also get to the news here in a few minutes. But before we do that, Mike, we do have to remind folks, you want to tell them a little bit about Robo Business, our call for presentations being open.
Yeah, so you, just a reminder, folks, we are trying to pull the agenda together here. Steve and I and Brianna are actively reviewing the presentation submissions. Robo Business is going to take place in October 18th and 19th in Santa Clara. And if you got something interesting that you want to talk about, submit your proposal. Also a reminder for anybody that's in the outdoor robotics space, we will have the field robotics session as well. And so if you're doing something interesting there, I would love to feature your work.
Yeah, already have a ton of great folks that have sent stuff in. We'll be announcing our agenda over the next few weeks, slowly dripping things out. You can check out the agenda, the show floor, and all the other stuff at robobusiness.com. Again, we'll be updating that website as you go. But of course, we are the producers behind the Robotics Summit and Expo, which took place last month in Boston. So if you were a fan of what we did there, we're doing pretty similar stuff on the West Coast, but as Mike alluded to, a focus on field robotics systems. So anything that operates in a hectic outdoor environment. So again, go to robobusiness.com. You'll see the form to enter a submission for consideration. Again, I think the deadline is June 16th, but we'll also include a link to that website in our show notes as we go here. So moving to the news here, Mike, we're going to quickly recap our days at Automate. What was that, last week, a couple weeks ago? Yeah. I can't remember, in Detroit. So we were there for a few days. Lots of great stuff. And again, folks, we have you covered with our network of websites covering the global robotics industry. Check us out at The Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, Mobile Robot Guide, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. I guess, Mike, we'll just start with you. Tons of robotic systems there. What were some of the highlights for you?
Well, you know, the three of us were there, you, me, and Brianna, we sort of had a plan. Brianna started at one end of the show. I started at the other end of the show when we walked the whole show floor. And you were just bouncing around. You had lots of folks to talk to. So I think we did a pretty good job of covering, you know, the show both in depth and seeing everything that was there. So it was fun to do that. In my adventure, and I think you and I both agreed on this as one of the most interesting things that was on the show floor, was that there was an original Unimate,
right,
in the Kawasaki booth. That was so fun to actually walk around, to touch, to see. What did you think about that? Seeing that, have you seen one before?
I had never seen one before. It's like, that's the robot that got everything going, right? So it's, yeah. It's kind of, you know, it's is it real? It's weird to actually see one in person. And one of the gentlemen that I talked to in the Kawasaki booth, shout out Kawasaki for bringing that, by the way, said that they had maybe a dealer meeting or something a couple of days before Automate took place, and they actually had it up and running and moving around in their office. I don't know if that was in Detroit or where it was. But that was pretty cool. So it wasn't moving in the Automate booth, but they had it moving not too long before the show. So that would have been
functional. It's still functional, which is cool.
It's still functional. Yeah. And on top of that, there was in the same booth, in the Kawasaki booth, I forget what the name or the model of the robot, but it was right next to the Unimate. It was an arc welding, right? A spot welding robot. And this thing looked like it was probably 40 years old itself. And they said that it was still operational up until recently. And that the only reason it's no longer, or I guess the reason it was retired, is that the only person at the facility who knew how to program this welding industrial robot had also retired. So nobody, I'm assuming it's not as easy to program as some of these robots are nowadays. So that historical knowledge of how to program and really get the most out of this robot kind of left the door when this guy retired as well. So just incredible to see these robots that are decades old. That
and you know, and you know what I did, Steve, I've got on my iPhone 14 Pro or whatever, I forget what my iPhone is, I've got the capability to do a live 3D scan. So I actually created a live 3D scan of that Unimate using some of the 3D photogrammic software. So I actually captured that. It was pretty cool to now have that. I can always go back and look at it in detail.
Yeah, and just looking at the controller, you know, for the Unimate, right? Just to see how far the technology has come was kind of really interesting for me to see. And I don't think anybody knew it was going to be there outside of the folks from Kawasaki. I remember asking Jeff Bernstein from A3 if he knew it was going to be there. He didn't know. So kind of a feather in our cap to see something like that. But other than that, you know, I think you and I had talked a little bit about it. I mean, there's so many things there. I don't know how many of them are actually new to me, right? The thing that I was probably most interested to come across, was, besides the Unimate, of course, was what ABB teased in its booth. It didn't have it there. They're unveiling it, I think, at Automatica, which is happening later this month, I believe, over in Germany. Did you go by the booth and see this? They're releasing... Yeah. These modular industrial robot arms. I think there's 22 different variations ultimately that are going to be possible with this. And think of it as a Lego concept, is they have these interchangeable pieces.
Links, the different link sizes, right? They can put a different.
Exactly. If you need, if you know, they sell these standard, you know, options right now with certain reaches and certain payloads. If a workflow changes or there's a new process that a company brings on board and they need a robot that can reach, I don't know, a few meters more or whatever, a little bit further outside of the capabilities of their current robot, instead of having to go and buy a whole new robot, ABB is making these modular systems with these links. Now they're claiming that the end user themselves will be able to quickly interchange these links. So make their a longer reach for the robot arm, make a shorter reach for the robot arm, something like that. And again, 22 different variations they're coming out with at Automatica later this month. And then later on, I believe this year, they're going to introduce a higher payload series of the same idea with these modular interchanging links. And we've seen modular robots in other form factors, right, with the modular actuators and stuff like that, but nothing from a global leader like this. And to me, when I saw that, when I first heard about it, my immediate reaction is, well, doesn't that mean that ABB is now going to sell fewer robots to their customer base? Now, that might be true, but what they're saying is overall, it's a better product. It's a more flexible product. It's going to make their customer base happier. But they also talked about just the internal financial savings that come with having less SKUs, so less issues with supply chain, less marketing, less service calls, all that sort of behind the scenes logistical marketing, PR stuff that comes with each additional model number in a lineup. A lot of that now goes away as they've develop, and I don't know exactly how it works. We're hoping to have somebody on ABB onto the show close to when this stuff launches, but I'm assuming they've pulled it off. I'm assuming it's as easy to use as they claim it is. I mean, it's ABB. They're one of the best companies to ever do it. So to me, that was by far the coolest thing that I saw.
Well, and it's going to, you know, make the life of the robot that much longer. So at the end of, you know, say an automotive production run, when they're retooling the line, now they could just change the robot if they need longer reach for the next model year to do a longer weld or to pick in place or put something, in during the assembly process. So overall improves the ROI for end users, which, who doesn't want that? So,
yeah, right. So we're in talks with ABB and to trying to get Mark Segura. I think he's their head of global robotics is his title, I think. Mm-hmm. But we're hoping to have him on in the coming weeks to really talk about this and sort of unpack it. But again, just to finalize this thought here, just a string of really awesome moves by ABB over the last, couple of years or whatever it's been, to really try to make themselves a one-stop shop for a lot of different robotics needs. They have the AMRs now through that AMR acquisition, ASTI Mobile Robotics, right? They've added the SLAM-based navigation to that. They've improved the quality of their collaborative robotic arms. Now they come out with this, to me, groundbreaking, game-changing modular industrial robot arm. So again, just a string of really, really awesome moves by ABB. In my opinion. But what was your, besides the Unimate, what was the coolest thing you saw at the show?
Well, there's, as I told you, I got a chance to walk and see everything in every booth. And one of the things that I stumbled on, and your favorite word, I serendipitously discovered, yep. Was a company out of Canada. They're called Robot 9. And a very interesting design for a robot that you wouldn't really consider, but it's a everybody watches football or soccer, depending on where you're at. I mean, U.S. football, and it's also in any of the big arenas, those cable cameras that fly over the field.
Skycam.
Skycam gets you close to the action. So basically, they've built a robot built on that concept of the Skycam. And the way the Skycams work, and I'll describe how this one's different, is that the Skycams have cables in four corners of the platform, and the motors are up in the attachment points up in the top of the arena, right? And so they reel in and reel out the cable, and that's what moves the platform around with the camera on it. They built a similar idea, and basically they got a contract from the Canadian government to fund the development of this. They've built a similar platform for aircraft airframe inspection. So imagine in a hangar, you want to fly a sensor array over the aircraft to inspect the aircraft surfaces for, defects, for, repainting or whatever the case may be. But what they did differently than putting the motors into the corners of the building and attached to the building, they moved the motors to the platform, Steve, and they actually have three motors on each corner for a total of 12 motors on this platform. And there's three individual, they're not cables, they're actually cogged belts that attach, and that's how they get the real positive connection with this. So three cogged belts in each corner going up to the attachment points. And this provides a very stable platform. And one of the problems with the cable cams in the arena is that as the camera gets to the corner and starts to get pulled into one corner, that corner of the platform starts to get pulled up, and there's no way to really compensate for that. What they have with this 12 motor design is that, and three attachment points for each corner, is that they can keep the platform entirely parallel to the ground surface, right? And they can also very accurately position it, and it also provides stability to that platform. And so what they've done now from the initial design, which was aircraft inspection, is they're looking for other ways to deploy this now. So for anybody out there that needs sort of an overhead gantry style of motion, but wants it with a little bit faster actuation, because this thing can really move quickly. They showed a demo video of hanging a collaborative robot underneath of this. So now imagine another 2 meters of robot hanging underneath of this platform. They're able to fly it around over something and manipulate the robot as well. But I saw it move, and you would imagine that this robot would swing like a pendulum at its endpoint, right? As the mass of that robot hanging from this platform would move it. And there was none of that. It's stable enough to move this collaborative robot around and keep the settling at the endpoints stable, so it can get very quick actuation and movement. So I look forward to following this company. The website is rbot9.com if you want to go check it out.
Yeah, I don't know how I missed this at the show. I didn't see it when I was there. You know, you told me about this after the fact, and I've never seen anything like this. I would love to see this in person at an actual facility, right? Yeah. I'm looking at, and we'll include links to their website. They have a couple breakdowns of potential warehouse-related applications. One of them is automated case picking in conventional racking, and another one is automated palletizing. Mm-hmm. And this case picking one is really interesting to me. It almost looks like an ASRS system in a way, where you see these automated forklifts that can run up and down, trying to pick different boxes off of shelves. The picture that they have is two of these hanging from a ceiling. So think about the range of motion that they can cover, the area that they can cover with these cables. And it's just they're relaying that they can pick these cases off of the racking in a conventional warehouse. So I always go back to what the great Helen Greiner told me many, many years ago when she was first getting into the drone space was, if you could do anything in the air, why wouldn't you? It's a lot easier to do that than try to develop a mobile robot, for example, that has to avoid all of these different obstacles that could be in its way. And this is exactly like that, is they're coming down from the air, right? So they don't have to worry about any hazards that might be in their way, because there isn't anything, right? They're using the ceiling space in a lot of cases to be able to do this. So that's wild. They have a picture of the robot arm hanging on the bottom of the roll cap product, and that's just crazy. I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, really.
Did they actually have a demo of it at the show, or was it just sort of informational setup?
They had a small scale 3D model that was about 2 feet by 2 feet, you know, space. Yeah. that illustrated a 3D, you know, what it would look like, and then they had a, you know, big TV screen showing it actually operating, and then they showed off the demo reel, the reel for the actual motors in the corner.
Right. Very cool. All right, quickly, let's run through some of the other things. Slip Robotics, which I think I saw at ProMat a couple of months ago, that I thought was a very interesting solution, where it's this large AMR that gets preloaded by a human with a couple pallets on top of it, and then the AMR itself drives into the back of a tractor trailer. I think you got an answer to one of the questions that we were asking some folks in the logistics business. They were concerned about how does it potentially move or lock itself into place while, again, it's designed to drive itself into the back of a tractor trailer and stay there as the tractor trailer drives it from one warehouse to another. But you got a pretty good answer about how they're hoping to do that safely.
Yeah, it was interesting. The guys there at the show who I talked to, Christian and Jordan and Dennis, the three guys from the company, what happened was, I was kneeling down. They're like, who's this? They knew me. But unlike any other customer, I was really, you know, checking out all the technology that you can't see from the website. And the first thing that I did was kneel down. I said, so how do you keep this thing from moving? And the system actually has a parking brake, and it's this additional pad that comes down in each four corners, sort of like a car jack, and actually contacts the floor and lifts the robot up slightly, because the system has Mecanum wheels, right? And right. So with Mecanum wheels, the system would be slipping around if you don't put something to positively brake it. So that's how they do it. Each corner has a parking brake, lifts up the robot slightly so it doesn't slide around. And so that answered that question. I was very satisfied, you know, looking at this robot and talking through the software and the intelligence about how they interact with operators, you know, to unload this once the trailer shows up. So I talked through them, you know, the whole control interface and how an operator would actually interact with these robots. So very cool.
Yep. Yep, very cool. We saw an update from wheel.me. I forget exactly where they're from. I came across them a number of years ago, I think at CES. This is probably going back prior to the pandemic. But what is very cool about this solution is, instead of building the entire autonomous mobile robot in different form factors, they're essentially making the individual wheels and the casters able to autonomously navigate and attach to a number of different form factors. So regardless of what, you know, cart system or whatever, a warehouse company uses in their facilities. Their idea here is that they can come in and retrofit their autonomous wheels to anything that you have that you want to be able to have autonomously navigate around a warehouse. But we saw a demo, Mike, at the AMR area at Automate.
Yeah, and the system uses Mecanum wheels, so the wheels operate in a swarm fashion. So you can put four wheels, you can put six wheels, you can put eight wheels underneath of any sort of platform surface that you need to move around. And then it's designed, the wheels coordinate, even though they're individual control points, they coordinate to move the entire vehicle. And so it was just great to see it, touch it, look at it up close and personal. All right.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool stuff. We saw, you and I were going back and forth on this because I saw Locus a long time ago released a video where they reskinned, I think, one of the Vector AMR from Waypoint. But now at this booth, they also had a reskinned Max AMR in their booth. As they were saying, this show is more geared towards the manufacturing industry. So they wanted to highlight their heavy duty payload AMRs at the show, but you were impressed by the new design.
Yeah, it looks great. I mean, again, in terms of the evolution of the Waypoint AMRs into the Locus ecosystem, the entire robot portfolio now looks consistent, looks like it came from the same company because it is now. And so, those robots integrate seamlessly in the operation and movement of material, regardless of whether it's a pallet or whether it's a tiny part SKU being pulled for customer order. Right?
Yeah, very cool. This just looks better with the white design, doesn't it? Doesn't it just look so much, it just like pops more.
Right.
I don't know if that helps them sell more, but it definitely... definitely, it looks a lot better. So there were some several live demos of mobile manipulators, Mike, that we saw at the show. But I know you also got to see Robotnik for the first time live.
Yeah, that was cool. I've been following Robotnik for a long time. They were acquired in January by United Robotics Group. They had their robots running around as well. So it was a chance to look at those guys up close and personal. They're all sort of unique designs. I think there's going to be some evolution of that now that they have a new home with United Robotics Group. But just a chance to see those things live and in person. That was really cool.
Yeah, they acquired the Sawyer robot from Rethink back in 2021. I think United Robotics Group, did they just acquire SoftBank too? Maybe SoftBank Robotics, so maker of Eldabaran a couple of years, back in the day. So they're doing some great stuff over there at the United Robotics Group. All right. Well, that's our Automate recap, I believe, right? So great show. As always, great job by the folks over at A3. Great to see them. Great to see everybody else at the show. Obviously, feel free to send Mike and I your thoughts if we missed something, which is very possible with the size of that show. If you saw something there that was innovative, please let us know. You know how to get in touch with us. On to the regular news quickly here, Mike. PAL Robotics introduced a new mobile manipulation platform.
Yeah, so they introduced their Tiago Pro Edition mobile manipulator. They've had Tiago for, going on a decade now. It's their humanoid-like research platform. It uses wheels, not legs. But Tiago has two arms, mobile manipulators, and the hardware upgrades on this Pro Edition include joint levels, full torque controllable arms with brakes at each joint. The arms have 7 degrees of freedom. And so, really it's a great research platform for universities that are doing research on, perception and interaction with arms. And again, I think it's leading to this wave that we're seeing in humanoid development. All of that contributes to the future there for humanoid-like robots.
Yeah, very cool stuff. Another important story, we'll kind of breeze over this one, but we'll include some links to it in the show notes. NVIDIA made some pretty major updates for Metropolis for factories. It's Isaac AMR suite and much more. I think Jensen gave his first, in-person keynote in a number of years, almost 4 years. So a lot of great stuff there that we can let you guys unpack. Again, we'll include a link to that in the show notes. But I thought this was one of the cooler stories that we've written in a while, and very quickly shot up the ranks, Mike, to the number one story on the Mobile Robot Guide for the last month in just a couple of days, right?
48 hours, it became the number one red story.
Yeah, this Ukrainian tractor automation company developed their own homegrown demining solution. And I think we all are aware of why they need something like that right now. But take us through quickly this product.
Yeah, so very interesting. We know that the Ukraine is a hotbed of innovation, both in cloud-based solutions, but even in other autonomy areas. And the Ukrainian company eFarm.pro has been around, I think, five, maybe almost a decade now. They've been developing their auto driving solutions, much like John Deere has an auto drive solution for tractors, for John Deere tractors. They developed a retrofittable auto drive solution that would auto steer tractors for Ukrainian farmers. And so when the war happened, and with all of the military actions, a lot of mines left in and unexploded ordnance left in fields. And of course, farmers need to till and disturb the top ground. So it's a real danger for those farmers. So what eFarm Pro did is they took their auto drive solution for tractors, and they created an autonomous demining attachment for tractors. And the whole system includes a drone that can fly overhead and look for potential disturbed areas or where ordnance has landed and maybe not exploded, right? So it identifies those areas. And then the auto drive tractor then goes back out with an attachment that disturbs the topsoil. They can first identify some of the obvious areas, and then actual individuals can go out and remove that ordnance. And then they've got this auto drive tractor that can run through the whole field just to try and disturb the area, explode an ordnance. And the tractor has, steel plates to make sure that it doesn't get damaged. It might destroy the implement, which can be repaired. But then they can guarantee for that farmer that they can go and do whatever they need to do to till and get ready for planting. And again, up to 40% of agricultural fields are now unsafe, according to some statistics, due to all the military actions and the war in the eastern part of Ukraine. So
that's crazy.
A great homegrown solution for solving that. So kudos to innovation, folks, very smart 40. Folks over there. Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. 40%, right? If that number is accurate, and I have no reason to doubt that, that's incredibly, incredibly sad. But again, folks, we will include links to all these stories in the show notes when we publish the podcast. But again, to follow the global robotics industry, we have you guys covered with our network of websites. You can check us out at The Robot Report, Mobile Robot Guide, Robotics Business Review, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. Now we're going to pivot now to our interview with Roberta Nelson Shea. Again, she's the Global Technical Compliance Officer at Universal Robots, also recently the winner, the application winner in the Joseph Engelberger Robotics Awards for her outstanding work over the course of her career in global robotics safety. Again, we don't dive too deep into the nitty-gritty of what the standards are that she's developed and how they're making robots safer. What we really wanted to get out of her was her career, the process that which she's undergone to get some of these standards passed. How did she get everybody, all these folks from around the world, on board? She shares a couple nightmarish stories of very unsafe installations that she came across in her years. That's towards the end of the podcast. But again, a great storyteller. So we encourage you folks to listen all the way through. It's a little bit of a longer interview here, which is great, as Roberta herself is great, and this award is very she's well deserving of winning this award. So I'm not sure where the industry would be without her relentless efforts to get some of these standards implemented around the world. So again, here's our interview with Roberta Nelson Shea. All right, Mike, honored to be speaking with our next guest, Roberta Nelson Shea. She's the Global Technical Compliance Officer at Universal Robots. She was recently the application winner for the 2023 Joseph Engelberger Award, which was given out at the Automate Show a couple of weeks ago. So she won for her outstanding work over the course of her career in global robotics safety. So again, honored to be joined by Roberta. First off, congratulations on the win. Well deserved. How you doing?
I'm fine, and thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Our pleasure. We saw you, Mike, and I saw you at the award ceremony at Automate. So great speech, great little video that honored some of the work that you're doing. But let's just start. I think the Engelberger Award is always referred to as the Nobel Prize of the robotics industry. What does it mean to you to have won that award?
Well, obviously it means a lot because I never expected it. It was a big surprise, a very big surprise and a very welcome surprise. I'm not used to there being an award for being involved in safety. I'm used to being used as a resource, obviously, but also I'm used to in a small way, people thinking safety. Oh, yeah. Rats, we're going to have to think about that. But that really has not been the case within the robotics world. The robotics world really did embrace it. And I don't know if it's because people think Terminator, so they're really sure a lot of attention is needed, or if this came down from when we all started, it was at a big push from the big three. So GM, at that time, Chrysler and Ford, all basically told the robotics industry, if there's not a safety standard that labor feels comfortable with, we're not buying robots. So this is something that has to be solved. So in this instance, you have a very large industry who was at that point in time the big customer of robotics saying, this is really important. Do something about it. And the industry really took that to heart and has given a great deal of attention to it. So I'm very proud of it, and I'm very proud of the progress we've made. It's a wonderful thing.
How did you find out that you won? Do you remember where you were?
Yes, I was home, and that's actually a little bit of a humorous story. I was home, and I had just called my dentist's office. My dentist is in Michigan, just so you know, and his name is Jeffrey Burstein.
Oh, get out of here.
I'm not kidding. And I just called to make an appointment. And Jeff Bernstein of A3 called. And so he said, he called me and he's like, oh, hi, how are you? And I said, I'm fine, but I've got a little bit of a problem with my tooth. And I started right in on it. And Jeff said, well, I'm really sorry to hear about that, but I'm calling you about an award. And I was thinking, and I called my dentist, Jeff. I've been going to him forever. And I said to him, why would my teeth get an award? This went back and forth. It's like, who's on first? And he says, this is Jeff Bernstein. And I said, yes, I know. And I'm trying to figure out when we can get together. And Jeff Bernstein said, it will be at Automate. Meanwhile, we're still on two different planets. And the problem with this is I've only had this encounter in confusion twice with Jeff Bernstein, in which I confused him with my dentist. And we had a very strange conversation until after some time, finally, this was the second time. So Jeff Bernstein said to me, with A3, I am not your dentist.
That's great. Because Jeff Bernstein also won an award, right? What did he call it? What was the nickname for him? He's a robotics industry defender by day and maybe a dentist by night. We're learning
here. Well, he's not going to take on that role, I can tell you. But anyway, the conversation was funny, as was the preceding one that we had, because although I've known Jeff Bernstein for many years, it's not like we call up and chat with each other. He's sure standards are all being handled well by his staff, and we tend to talk at social events, you know, like the forum in January and at Automate and wherever else. But it's kind of very informal. But that was how I learned of it. And it was not a very gracious acceptance when I kept talking about when's my appointment. But I've certainly, it's a fabulous honor. It really is. I don't know how else I can word it, but I think it's a fabulous honor to the robotics industry for the fact that they value safety. I mean, how many other industries, and when I originally started working, I was in manufacturing management at P&G, who has a very strong safety culture. And then I got into press room safety and automation. And, you know, there was not the belief. Some companies believe in safety, but not as an industry. But that's not the case with robotics. So the fact that the robotics industry and their trade association, A3, views it so highly, isn't that just wonderful?
Yeah, well, I think you said that really the early market demanded it. I think that's an important catalyst for why this became critical to the early part of the industry and why things have evolved. And I mean, you've had an interesting career as you just started down that path. So let's go with that for a minute. What sort of drew you to this, interest in safety, and then ultimately backing into the robotics world here, and where again, now you've been tremendously influential with your current career, and we'll get to that as well in this story. But how did you get pulled into the event horizon of safety, so to speak?
I wish I could tell you it was a planned path. It was not.
That's good for any of the young listeners, right? Sometimes
some young people have a vision of their future, and no matter what, all steps lead to it. Mm-hmm. I have a brother who is like that. He's a scientist, and he knew from the time he was about 14 or 15 exactly what he wanted to do for his world. And I didn't. I really have only learned that what I'm doing is really what I want to do. And that's been within the past few years. So what, it took me to my mid-60s to say, what do I want to do when I grow up? Yeah, that's literally what happened with me. And I have one of my kids, like my brother, with a vision, and she announced it when she was 3 years old, never wavered. And I have my son, who everything is of interest to him. And how do you pick one fascinating topic over another? And so I think that we have people that are either in one camp or another. It's not that there's a third choice. It's either you know absolutely and you go for it, or you don't know and you just kind of take a path that meanders. So with my meandering path, I graduated from an engineering school. So obviously I thought I want to do engineering stuff. And I had no idea what that meant at the time, because you also have to understand, I grew up in a suburban neighborhood where my dad went to New York City every morning and worked in a skyscraper. I had no idea what a factory looked like. None. I had no idea what the jobs were in it. And until I went to a college, I didn't know what an engineer did. And so then you get out of college. Now I got an idea of what an engineer does, but not where they do it, not the people around you, not the company, not the environment. And so you spend at least about, 5 years bumbling your way through all of that. And I came to the decision, I don't want to work full time in a factory. So you learn things one lesson at a time. Mm-hmm. And I went to work in P&G's manufacturing management program. Great company, learned a lot. But I also learned I don't want to work each and every day in a factory. So I said, okay, now I'm going to try sales. So I went into sales. And as far as a business or an area to be in, it was more suited to me. I liked the interactions. I liked the fact that I didn't feel trapped in an office, like the gate at the guard check goes mm-hmm. clank behind you and you're like, are they going to let me out later? Mm-hmm. Which the company didn't give that impression. I just felt that way. And I enjoyed sales. And the sales company I was with, they made safety and automation controls for the metal stamping industry. Mm-hmm. And so I really enjoyed both aspects, the automation and the safety. I really did not enjoy the metal stamping industry, because it was an industry where some embraced safety and automation, but it was company by company and some did not, and that was very depressing, because the injuries and issues in metal stamping are not minor. Life altering, just right. Horrific. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I saw that there was an interest in writing, and I don't remember where it was, something written back then when everything was published, written, and there's magazines, that there was going to be the first meeting of a robot safety standard group. And it was a call to people saying, if you're interested, please come to. And at that point in time, RIA, which became A3, was located in SME. They had just broken off to be a separate group, but they were still located in there and they hadn't moved to Ann Arbor. And I went to the meeting and I really enjoyed it. And I really felt like I was going to make a difference, and that here were companies that wanted this to be better. So it was something that resonated with me, and I stayed at it. It's as simple as that. No matter where I've gone with other jobs or things that I have done, it has always been with the threat of robotics, safety, automation. Mm-hmm. And I've gone through various roles, various companies. And each of them you take away something from, and for the next one, you hope you keep getting closer and closer to what might be that wonderful thing at the end, but never knowing if you'll ever reach it. You know, there was one point in time I wanted to be a translator at the UN, and I studied a lot of foreign languages. Then I went to engineering school, where you were lucky if people could speak English, and they're Americans. You know, life is just many turns, and I think that we just have to grab that which appeals to us and you move forward. And let's be realistic. Robots are cool.
Yeah, they're very cool, right? That's why Mike and I love our jobs as well.
Yeah.
Right?
We talk
to people, exactly. You and some other tremendous people. So take us through some of the things that maybe you've accomplished from a standards standpoint. I don't think we have to dive too deep into each standard, but I know one of the things that you're very well known for is you led the introduction of ISO TS15066. That's the first document that defines standardized safety requirements within human-robot collaboration. But from your vantage point, with some of the standards work that you've done over the last few decades, what are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of the robot safety standardization because, the industry really wanted it. The other thing is, it is the only machinery safety standard that has been adopted in all the countries that it's adopted. So what started as a national standard for me in the US is R1506, all those many years ago, way back when in 1982 was our first meeting. R1506 was brought internationally to ISO, and then within that international community, it was pulled into two parts, one for the robot manufacturers, one for integrators, and that is the current standard in ISO. And then it came back to the U.S. and was adopted, both parts under one cover, as the latest R1506. But what many people don't realize is that those two standards have been adopted for Europe. They're what's called harmonized standards in Europe. They've also been adopted in Canada. They're referenced in Mexico, Brazil, adopted in Japan, adopted in Korea, adopted in China, adopted in India. And there's a bunch of other countries that also have adopted it, but call it a different standard number. So an example of that is Australia, New Zealand. And so I don't know of any other machinery type standard that has that wide a degree of acceptance and adoption. I mean, it is absolutely amazing. And I still participate in a lot of standards that are considered general safety standards. And these are the ones that are supposedly the most, you know, they're really important. They really are. And all of the machine standards reference them. I can go to a meeting and there's six people there from around the world, six people. But robot safety standards, this is not just in the U.S. when we have a national committee meeting, we typically now have maybe 30 to 35 people. This is just U.S. alone. And then internationally, before COVID, we had meetings that we had 70 people at. And even now, after COVID, our meetings are typically I maxed out at 40. So 40 people attending from all sorts of countries with all sorts of input. But the more people that you have involved in a standard, then the greater likelihood of them saying this is good, because you always like your own baby. You know, that's part of it. But because they're all involved and they contribute, it gets better. I firmly believe that having a diversity of people, countries, opinions working on a standard makes it better, because it we don't want something that is just, you know, a single view. We really need to understand all of the views and what to do. So I don't know of any other machinery standard that has that degree of engagement and adoption. So I'm really super proud of that. And within A3, they made a decision. We're better off to get a smaller piece because if they adopt an international standard, they don't make 100% of the profits in selling it. They make a portion of that. And A3 at the time, RIA, made the decision. We think it's better to get a smaller percentage of what will ultimately be a bigger pie than it makes. You know, we are short-sighted if we just keep with our own little national standard and make sure it's different. And what that has meant for the whole industry is that all robot manufacturers, and now I work for one, Universal Robots, we make one robot that goes around the world. So for a given payload robot, there's no difference in what goes around the world. The only difference is the end of the power cord that gets put in the box. It's whatever will plug into that country. So, you know, you think at one point in time, I know that all the major robot manufacturers early on before I was with UR, for all of them, they would have a North American robot. They would have a European robot. They would have a Japanese robot. They would have almost like a Japanese robot for Korea, and then a Chinese robot and so forth. That's really expensive. That's expensive to design. That's expensive to make. That's expensive to support. So the robot manufacturers, they all woke up to the fact of, gosh, this is a way to save money. And this is a way to get more robots, purchased and used throughout the world. And the same thing for integrators. Integrators, it means that they only need to one standard. And that's what they have to apply for around the world. There are some nuances about electrical supply and that sort of thing, but the amount of differences went from huge to tiny, and that's cost savings. And that means that then all the integrators can become more expert because they're not trying to do something for one country, drop that, pick up something else, and then get their head into that. And at the end, all of the end users have benefited because robot prices have come down over the years. They have products that are the same, including lines, no matter where they get installed. So if they've got a plant in the UK, they've got a plant in Missouri, and they've got a plant in Ontario, the same design can go everywhere. And
I think implicit what you said as well, including the integrators in that ecosystem and path to market, is that it also lowers the barrier to entry so that and shortens the deployment process. That's what I wanted to get to for the integrators. The whole risk assessment can be well thought out and standardized. And so the customer acceptance period happens that much faster.
Yeah, that's worked out very well. Let's be realistic. We talked about risk assessment way back in the 80s, if you can believe it. And the 1999 standard came out with a methodology in it that we all worked on. And you're right. One big difference between many other standards and the robot standard is that there is participation from machine builders. There is participation from integrators and participation from end users. Most machinery safety standards will have the manufacturer. And if this is of high importance to end users, you'll have some end users. You don't tend to have many integrators. And it's just, I know time is a precious commodity and what can you spend your time on? But we really got very high engagement. And I think it really improved the work product. So I'm super, super proud of that progress. And I'm also super proud of the fact that the industry bought into all of it.
What do you think is the key there? I mean, you mentioned cost savings or selling more robots, but, you know, Mike and I are in the party planning business, right? Ourselves a little bit. We put on in-person events, and we see how hard it is to get people together to learn about new robots, something exciting, right? Standards and safety, as you've said, is not the most exciting things of all time. So what were some of the secrets that you could share to get all these different types of folks to buy into this?
Well, some of this is just inertia. So initially, the big three, they really pushed it. And so people started participating more, including integrators. Hmm. And integrators said, we're being demanded by whatever customer that we have to comply with this. And we don't even know what it means. Tell us what to do, which you can't really do that. How do you tell somebody what to do when you don't even know what they're trying to do? And so it was almost like group therapy. In fact, I've described some of our activities as group therapy for putting together robot systems. And we've only been involved in the safety aspect. When it came to risk assessment, that was really new to everybody. And everybody was super scared of it. I have no other way of putting it. And I still see that to this day. So I increasingly hear from many companies, most all are integrators, some are end users. Well, how do I do a risk assessment? Mm-hmm. And I'd like to think that since this has been talked about for 30 years at least, why do we have these people that don't understand it? Well, they probably never really got into it. If you dabble a little bit, if you just use common sense, you might say, this is fine. But as things get more complicated, then you have to put some more time and effort into it. And with the greater time and effort, you realize, well, I keep being asked for the risk assessment and I've never done it. This just seems to, this is sensible. There's no access here. I've taken care of this and that. And I think we've just matured. If you hear about something long enough, then you're asked to do it once. And the first time is utterly painful. Mm-hmm. The next time, not nearly as painful. And then by the time you get to the fourth or fifth time, you're like, oh, this is nothing. And that's really what I've seen about doing a risk assessment. It's really not a big deal. You just have to hunker down and just get it over with. Mm-hmm. The most important thing is consistency. So I wish I could tell you I had a secret sauce for what makes the robot standards so wonderful. I can tell you it's not me, even though I've been on it all these years. It's not me. It's everybody who's at the table. Because what I've seen in other standards groups is if it's a brand new standard, there's a lot of posturing. You know, kind of like when dogs meet at the dog park. A lot of stiff leg walking, you know, kind of sizing up everyone, figuring out who's your enemy or something. And what happens over a little bit of time is that you have to let go of that, because the objective is to write a standard that's better than what's out there now. And if nothing is out there, something is better than nothing. So let's everybody get together and just keep remembering what the goal is. And it really does take almost about 6 months to a year before people start feeling comfortable. And also, it's not just comfortable enough to soften your position on some things, because you can't win everything. But it's also many people, particularly in the machinery or robotics world, we're all engineers. Engineers are known for being a bit introspective. They're not likely to stand up and pontificate or pound the table. Yeah, there's one here and one there, but that's not a typical engineer. Mm-hmm. So it's to make sure that everybody feels comfortable saying something, saying their opinion, or even saying, I don't understand something. We had one long-term colleague in Canada who did a lot to help further that sense of comfort or trust in the ISO meetings. And I'll give his name. His name is Dave Smith. He's retired from Honda. But he was absolutely comfortable standing up and saying, I've got no idea what you're talking about. Can somebody just explain what this means to me?
For an engineer, that's worthwhile, right? Yeah.
So for a lot of the people around the table who don't want to admit, I don't know what they're talking about with functional safety. I don't know what they're talking about. They just listed a standard. I heard alphabet soup. I don't know what it means. And we would have Smitty just kind of say, what the crap? Somebody give me a decoder ring. And He really broke the ice with so many things, as well as the fact that he started being our social organizer. So every time we had a meeting, he's already thought through, okay, why don't we all go to dinner here? Or why don't we all stay at this hotel? So there was a lot of them socializing after meetings, before meetings, and not just at the coffee breaks. So that one person, I think, did a tremendous he did a tremendous job for the safety standards work, because it's very important everybody speaks up. It's very important everybody feels comfortable, because at the end, when it comes back to your own country, you've got to hope that that person will say, we didn't get everything we wanted, but we got some stuff. I think this is good. We should move ahead. Because if any one person is really happy, then there's a lot of people really unhappy. Mm-hmm. We should be equally unhappy. That's the way I look at it. We should all feel that we got something, but not everything, because then it means that it's truly a balanced document.
Yeah. Well, I want to, given your current role at UR, you were there in the early days of the collaborative robotics introductions. And, you know, that was a stepwise change for the industry, the concept of robots that can operate without guarding.
Right? Yes.
They clearly didn't fit into the old mold if the big three were going to require guarding around all of the collaborative robots, then why have collaborative robots, right? I mean, there's a functionally different use case. So tell us a little bit about how collaborative robots sort of upended this whole robot safety and what's taken to make the end users comfortable.
Yeah, I can tell you that I firmly believe the robot safety standard is the one that did the upending, because I remember being in a meeting in actually Stockholm where we just had a philosophical discussion of, well, if you can't be hurt, why do you need a guard? That started it in the robot safety standard. Hmm. And we wrote about it and talked about it in the early 2000s. And we kept talking about it. And then eventually initial wording got into the current robot safety standard for part two, integration in part one. But not a whole lot of information. It was just, if in the risk assessment, nobody can be hurt, blah, 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 blah. And you could have power and force limiting, no description of what that required. So a lot of vague statements. And then we all realized, well, we need what ended up being 15066. We needed more. We needed a lot more. Mm-hmm. And just with that happening, what you saw was a market explosion. And I think some of the market explosion, being absolutely honest, was because of being touted, you don't need any guarding. But really, let's be realistic. Those initial robots were all very small payload in comparison to the typical robot. Hmm. So what we have seen that has exploded really is the market of small payload, whereas previously it wouldn't be bought. Now, part of that is the notion of collaborative applications. Part of that is now we've gotten to the point that, you know, the way to program many of these newer robots is much simpler. You don't have to go to KUKA school. You don't have to go to FANUC school. Don't have to go to ABB school. That's not as a dig to them. You know, you've got to be, let's be realistic. When they first came out with their robots, you know, that was like the cat's meow. But that now also they have this legacy that they have to still keep providing the pendant. All companies that standardized on a particular make want to keep seeing it. Because why is that? We're typical human beings. We want what we're comfortable with. If we know something, we want to keep using it. I mean, I know that's the case with me, so I've got to presume that many others are like that. So this whole new collaborative stuff really was cracking the small payload nut. And you couldn't do it if you didn't have easy to program. And it opened up a lot of small and medium enterprises who I am sure this never was said by me, but I am sure they got interested because they thought, oh, I don't need to use any safety, so I can just get it in and use it. And in some instances, that's correct. But, you know, the classic thing we always say is if you put a knife in a gripper, no one is safe around that robot. Mm. So it's really all about the application. And now we're also, the small payload marketplace is maturing. And there's the realization, let's not talk about a collaborative robot. Let's talk about a collaborative application. So all of us in our robot safety standard we meet and we say, we let the horse get out of the barn before we close the doors, because we talked about collaborative robots. And really, you can't be sure that it's going to be a collaborative application. But live and learn. And probably, I should say, I think it was wise for us to try to poke our way forward, even if it was not as complete guidance as was has been needed. But we live and learn, and we get better. And you have a little bit of a catch-22 with standardization, particularly safety standardization. You can write a good standard if you've seen all the applications. Something in use, you can critically review and say, oh, well, really, this should have been done. That should have been done. And that's typically when you write a safety standard. When you have something in use, you have knowledge of it, you can assess the risks of how that was designed and integrated. And then you could say, oh, this needed a requirement for this. That's what you're supposed to do. You're not supposed to say, oh, I can just picture. If only we had, you know, Nirvana, wouldn't that be great? You know, and that's in a way what we did. We said, well, if it won't hurt a person, sure, why not? But we didn't say, how do you figure out if it won't hurt a person? What's the minimum contact surface area for contact? What's the sharpness that it has to be? When you say, oh, it can have compliance or give to it, how much give? How much force? How much pressure? So we had all these fabulous ideas, but insufficient guidance. 15066 helped with that. Mm-hmm. Not completely, because I can tell you that lots of people say, okay, but how do I measure this? And how can I get such dissimilar measurements? And on and on. So we're still moving forward and improving things. But we had a little bit of, if you want to say, the catch-22. Don't write about it until it exists, or give some enabling, meaning saying this is possible. And if you can do it and not hurt somebody, why not? And so that you get applications that you can then take a step back and say, oh, no, we need some additional things, or, oh, no, that was a worry and it didn't need to be a worry. And that's a catch-22, chicken or egg. Have an application, develop a new application.
Yeah. How closely do you look at emerging areas of robotics? So legged robots and humanoids or quadrupeds, or I'm a big fan of self-driving cars. I've ridden in several self-driving robo-taxis over the years. And I don't know if there's any standard for robo-taxis, right? I don't think there is, but I don't know that as I'm speaking to you. But do you look at other emerging robotics industries and just like cringe at how unsafe or lack of standards exist in those areas? Or
I got to be careful there, because the reality is every new market or application is in its infancy, and the products are not going to be as well done from a safety standpoint as later generations. That's reality.
That's just part of the game. Like not the game,
it's
but just part of
maturing. It's just part of maturing. So, you know, even if we go in the Wayback Machine for robotics, the first robots that we actually saw being used commercially in automotive were hydraulic robots, old bang bangs, meaning it just would go one position, another position. And high pressure hydraulics, which always leak. And if they leak, it's not low pressure. And that is a hazard. All the floors are slippery. And there's there are a lot of issues. But you know what? They could do something that couldn't be done before. And that's lift something very heavy and just do it repeatedly. So there's always a little bit of a trade-off, and you say, okay, well, now I'm not exposing people to those hazards, but we've got slip, trip, and fall hazards around it. We have fumes that occur that didn't occur before, but still it was better than what was there before. And so then the next generation of industrial robots were, when you talk about it being an electric style, meaning with motors and a DC control, and they didn't have much safety in them at all, to be very, very honest. Did we know any better? No. No. Did we learn? Yes. So that's why you keep seeing with every generation of a robot, even in industrial, they have become more robust from a safety standpoint, and the robot safety standards get more exacting. So then if we go to a completely new industry, and so the example there, as soon as you save a vehicle, that comes under government control. So they're not even looking to ISO or ANSI for a standard. Instead, they're negotiating with the government as to, if we do this, will you let us? And what are the conditions? And from a government standpoint, there has been, you know, a directive or a big push to automotive for at least 25 years, at least I knew of it 25 years ago, to get self-driving vehicles. The government's motivation is they then don't have to build as many highways or expand them. The more that the vehicle can be self-driving, and they expect there'll be, you know, some mistakes that happen and therefore an accident, but there'll be far fewer than us flawed human drivers, which you may have seen me being really careful in the stage. I was in a car accident 2 months ago, broke my ankle. So that was my first day wearing shoes, not a boot. So people get into car accidents. My husband was driving and he's a good driver, but happened. It will happen less with a machine because even if its perception is flawed, at least it'll be consistent. Human or inconsistent. So the government wants self-driving vehicles and to have some sort of pulsing network control so that entering a highway is highly integrated and speeds are all controlled. Distances between cars are all controlled. And with that, it means fewer accidents. They don't have to expand highways. They don't have to build more highways. Hmm. So you have to understand from the government's perspective, they want self-driving cars. And society would be better for it. And so the automotive industry, as with everything with any of these regulated industries, automotive and air, so airplanes, with any of them, government says, you can do this. We won't hold you to making it flawless, but it has to at least incorporate some of these things. Hmm. So you'll notice for a self-driving car, it doesn't say to you that its navigation is safe. Says it has navigation and it meets X requirements. Huh. So you have to put it in context. And so that's one thing where the government regulates it. Then if you talk about in industry is all motivated by the market because we don't have the government saying robots have to meet this or do this or whatever. It's based upon market demand. And in the industrial robotics sector, it was very demanding to improve safety. And if you want to have improved performance and improved stopping time and all of these things, it means robots have to be better and better and better. And that's where we've gotten to. But I've got to tell you, I would probably be very comfortable in a self-driving taxi. But I'm a strange person for all of my love of robotics. I'm almost a Luddite. I don't even have a blender to for making dough. I make bread by hand. Make cookies, everything. I find a fork works really good. and my egg beater is one that is this with gears. Why? It always works. I don't have to worry about a part not working, the motor burning out, and now it's not made anymore. So in some ways, I'm a Luddite in my personal life. Because let's be realistic, you can't fix a TV anymore. I remember when I could fix my own TV.
It's not even worth it from a price standpoint either.
No, right? It's not anymore. And that can be okay. But with robots, it got to the point where the price has been, if you want to say, brought down so much and the performance has been improved so much. As soon as you want to have something replaced, replacing it is probably about the same price as getting a new robot. Hmm. And you won't see that, for example, on a metal stamping press, because the value of that press is based upon how many pounds or tons of metal is in the product, because it is highly mechanical. And so in order to be able to stamp something flat, you have to have very precise and uniform and heavy structure. So updating control systems, they don't mind doing on a press, but they're not going to throw out a press. Robots, you do see thrown out. It's reached its end of life. And I had a conversation in UR's booth about that. Somebody said, well, can I repair this myself? And I said, why would you really want to do that? What do you think you're repairing? And he said, well, what was going to break? And I said, there's two joints probably on every robot that will wear out more than another joint, any of the other joints. So it just depends what your program is. What is it that you're having it being flexed and around? And sometimes it's one joint, sometimes it's another. It's usually the shoulder. Okay, so if that goes, you can replace the joint. It's, you know, I could say in our robots, it will all come apart. It can only get put back together one way. You put it all back together. Okay, the one joint's probably, I'm going to just make as a guess. Let's say it's 20% of the price of the robot. Well, by this point in time, our robot's performance is improved. By the time you have to replace one joint. So do you want to have a robot that will go faster with greater precision? Or do you want to replace a joint or two joints and have it be no better than it was before? What do you want?
I think there was a fear, of course, in robots in production. Something goes down. How quickly can I get it back in production, right? You know, the meantime to repair. Question in my experience was, you just replace the whole robot with have a spare. So if time is value of money, right? Don't go trying to troubleshoot the robot and the joint and replace the joint. Just swap in a whole new robot that you.
Yeah, and then you can repair it. You repair the one that went down. That does happen. Yeah. But also tell you, at one point in time, the things that you really had trouble troubleshooting were something in the control system.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you bring that up, and it's maybe one of the last questions for you is looking forward to with AI now as a black box, as a part of many of these robots, right? They're making decisions about how they do their job without any line by line move approach, open grip or closed grip or type of programmatic controls. I mean, does that fall under the auspices of safety now as well? What are some of the things about how AI is going to change the safety protocols of?
I don't think it's going to change it. But I'll back up. First of all, within a robot, the safety related parts, generally, if you want to think about it, is they set the guide rails. Hmm. Oh, you have a speed limiting safety function, and it means you're not going to go faster than X speed. Mm-hmm. And for some applications, it could be, and you don't want to go slower, or you want to have no more force than this, but it has to have a minimum force. An example is buffing. Mm-hmm. In order to be able to do proper buffing, you have to apply a particular force, and you want it to really be held to something. And so if it's safety related, you're setting the guide rails. AI can operate all at once within it. You don't care.
Interesting.
And even right now with robots and all of the safety built into them, it's not safe motion control. Hmm. The kinematics, the non-safety related system, is that which is doing path planning. The safety system makes sure that you don't go to a place you are prohibited, that you don't go to an operating condition that is prohibited, meaning speed, meaning pressure, meaning force.
Right. Okay.
But you're free to just do whatever you like within those guide rails or boundaries, I guess that's the best way to put it. And so I think that it'll be very good. AI was thought to, you know, and we even thought that once with one of our products for an add-on feature, bin picking. Oh, AI would be great. You can always then pick out, the part and learn from it. But the most difficult thing to do is bin picking.
Right.
Absolutely, positively. So what works great on one bin of parts doesn't work on the next bin. And it could be all the same material. It's just a slightly different shape. It could be exactly the same shape and size, but a slightly different finish. So we have a lot more that we can learn from and to do better with. But AI is great.
Any horror stories from your days that you care to share where maybe you were touring a factory or some end user with a total disregard for safety in their use of robotics that stuck with you all these years?
And not so much. It's almost the other way around. I went, oh, I've got a good one, which really me, which is bad. I didn't think of it. I think you try to suppress the bad memories. I went to a fairly small but very high precision shop that does machining and metal fabrication for the medical industry. So very, very precise. And they put in some new measurement tables, which I'm sure, as you know, need a very particular foundation and a very thick table. And the measurement equipment is very precise. And it's in a room that especially has the air cleaned and it's conditioned. And so they're used to thinking that's what's important. They buy a robot on eBay.
Uh-oh.
They were upset. Uh-oh. They were upset. I won't say the robot manufacturer's name because that's immaterial. But it's a major industrial robot manufacturer who's been around for many years. And they contacted that robot manufacturer saying, here's the model number of the robot I've got. It didn't come with a manual. Can I get one? And they said, sure. You know, you have to issue a PO and we'll send you the manual. Because by this point in time, the robot is like 20 years old, right? And the company was like, well, how much does that cost? And they said, well, that costs more than the robot, right? Wasn't that much, probably a couple hundred dollars. And I went in, they wanted to show it to me. And they showed me where they installed the robot. They weren't running it yet. The room they put it in, their QC room, had the robot in between two gauging tables with, you know, like marble or granite, like this thing, huge. And the robot had to operate completely almost in a tuck position because the reach of it would have punched out walls, the walls of this specially conditioned room.
So its working envelope was outside of the
confines
of the room.
And they couldn't restrict the motion. Because they're having it turn all the way around and back, and their times are tucked in, and they're reaching over, just barely clearing the ceiling. And there is a desk right in front of both of these stations. So there's a desk surface all within reach of the robot. And I said, are you going to move the desks away from there? The desk should be outside this room. You know, we can, you know, interlock the entrance, the door coming into the room. So, oh no, this is a premium desk space. People wait for seniority to come in here because it's air conditioned.
What?
Said, oh, no, and then I said, but a person could be hit by the robot. And they said, no, they'd hear it. And I said, I don't think they'll hear it at all. You're the person leaning into me to hear me talk to you because of all the noise in this room. And I said, they're going to be sitting with their backs to the robots within reach of the robot. The reach is not restricted at all. There's no safeguarding at all in here. The room could be the safeguard that could act as the guard, but you have to put people outside. Nope, not going to do it. And they asked me what I thought of it all. And they said, I will show you where we do the proofing and the testing because they bought two robots on eBay. We went over to their proof area. The proof area, the robot is being held down by sandbags. That's their idea of testing it out. And it's in a wide open room and the people just stand right next to it while they come in and they get tools from the tool room. And they said, what do you think? And I said, I really think this is an accident waiting to happen. This is unconscionable. I just have to strongly tell you, this is not good at all. And they said, well, maybe you don't want to come back here.
And oh, I said, my gosh.
You know, but this was the complete ignorance of it because for the people who work in that environment, they're used to using, let's say, precision CNC machines. Mm-hmm. So they're gauging things. They're thinking they're in control of everything. But you program it, you load the program, you forget about the fact that where a swing is, you back up your desk chair, you lean back and you have your head knocked off. It was really unfortunate. So that's one thing I did see, and I was really disheartened by it. And I felt terrible also for the poor salesman who thought he was showing me around and thinking somebody's going to want to talk to me. And I said, I think I've cost you all your business looking forward. But anyway, so that was one time. But there's another time that really strikes me, and it's for exactly the opposite reasons. I went into a facility And it was as if the robot cell were under stage lights. It was, I could almost picture music. Da-da-da-da! And I'm looking at the robot cell, and it's well lit. It's got everything you can imagine and all sorts of entry points you can get to, and it's all safeguarded. And 10 feet away is a full rev power press with Igor hand feeding, no safeguarding. And they said, what do you think of this? And I said, I think your emphasis is on the wrong syllable here. The robot looks beautiful, but oh my God, how long do you think he's going to keep his arms? And it's actually rather rare or not as often to see frightening things with robotics.
Yep.
It does happen. And then what also happens is a serious injury occurs. Because the classic thing you say is it's not a question of if, it's when. And I say that with fair skin, showing you a beach scene. I've shared with my kids, it's not a question of when I get skin cancer. Or it's not a question of if I get skin cancer. I will get it someday. My brother's had lesions. My husband, you have fair skin. You will develop it. You just have to be vigilant. So the better thing to do is, I wish they had sunblock when I was a kid. They didn't. I live with that. But if you're going to have any piece of automated machinery, you have to think really thoughtfully, just thoughtfully. How does this go into place? How do people use it? How do we make, you know, the easy way to work the safe way? That's all that has to happen. And with that, I think things turn out pretty well. But so that's my two stories, two different extremes.
Well, thank you for sharing those. And yeah, to all of your hard work, not a lot of those incidents occur. But I'm sure there's still a lot more work to be done in your eyes, right? So just quickly to sort of wrap things up here, what's next on the safety front?
Well, what's next is we're towards the end of revisions to the current safety standards. And that will mean there'll be a new R1506, just as there'll be a new 10218-1 and -2. And really, it's kind of being held up due to backlogs in Europe, because in order for the standards to be harmonized, they have to go through what's called a harmonization evaluation. And unfortunately, our European government ran out of money last year, so they stopped doing evaluations. They refunded it and restarted it. And by the time they restarted it, there's a huge backlog, and we're in the backlog. Although what I will say is that the harmonization review is one in which you have technical experts really looking critically at the safety standard. So we have gotten really good feedback. And I think that the new revisions will be improved from being concise about what's required for safety. So it'll be improved. I just wish that it did not cause the delays that it has. I'm hopeful. It looks a bit dim. I'm hopeful the new standards will be published by the end of the year. I think we're now looking more realistically into first quarter 2024. But new revisions, and if I look at what's already out there and the new revisions, I could say quite honestly, I don't think there's that many changes. Because it's just the big difference is it's much more concise. There is more ambiguity in the wording. And in some instances, that was almost the intent in writing it. Because you had all these countries saying, well, this means this to me, this means this to me, and I don't like this, but I do like this. So you end up with something a little more vaguely worded so that all sorts of people would like it because it's vague. No more vagueness allowed. And so there's a good and a bad about it. But we've had not only all of the same countries, but additional countries. So we've had now India involved that was not before, Czech Republic, Mexico. What's another one? Russia, only by correspondence, though, because that's a difficult thing these days. Sure. But anyway, we've had more countries involved. And so conciseness will be, I think, the name of the game. And there's going to be a big push for added functional safety, which more than 10 years ago, many people in the U.S. didn't really know the topic. So having requirements for it was kind of like asking somebody to dance with snakes. But 10 years goes by and we all learn. At least we all hope we learn. But certainly in the higher tech area, there's no choice. You learn or you're a dinosaur. And so we're all better posed for it. But I can tell you that the part one document is almost two times longer. So wow. It's almost like for every word, another word was added.
Wow.
And for part two, it's 2.5 times longer.
Oh, man.
But if I look at it critically, there's not really changes. So if you read what you're required to cover, there's not that many changes. It's just much more concise. So, but soon. Well, I don't know when. Soon.
Keep us posted. We'll keep our eyes peeled for that as well. One interesting nugget before we do let you go. It's the second time in 5 years that somebody from Universal Robots won the Joseph F. Yeah. Engelberger Robotics Award. Some guy named Esben Ostergaard. I don't know who
that is. Yes, he was one of the founders.
I know. I'm teasing. Yeah. Co-founder. He won back in 2018.
Yes. He is very proud of it.
Oh, as he should be. And you should be as well.
Yes, you should be. Yes.
I am very proud of it. I just was completely startled about it. I'm used to, as I said, safety is not really viewed as the glamour shot. And it certainly felt like a glamorous occasion at the awards night. And so it was very nice. I'm just not used to being the center of attention, particularly when I'm hoping I won't fall. Don't fall. Don't fall.
And you'll be a little bit more careful the next time Jeff Bernstein calls you, I guess.
You know, I now I've gotten to the point where I say, is this my dentist?
You have to edit the name in your contact on your phone.
Well, I can't because now I do have Jeff Bernstein of A3, his home number and his cell phone number identified to him. But if I glance at my phone and I say Jeff Bernstein, I think my dentist.
Yeah.
So it's almost like I have to then still ask because the dentist office comes up with his name, my dentist. There's only a difference in an N in one name and no N in the other. So it's not much of a difference. I've learned I'm going to ask, is this my dentist? I think Jeff Bernstein of A3 has learned to just say, Roberta, I'm not your dentist.
Identify himself when he calls you the next time.
There you go.
That is
well, great. Hey, this was great. You're a great storyteller. So please come back anytime. It was a pleasure to have you. Roberta Nelson Shea, she's the Global Technology Compliance Officer at Universal Robots and one of the 2023 Joseph F. Engelberger Award winners and the application winner for her work over the years in global robotics safety. Roberta, thank you so much for doing this.
Anytime. It's a pleasure to talk with you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks again to Roberta. Also should make note that Jeff Bernstein from A3, also a winner of the Engelberger Award this year for all that he's done for the industry. So congrats to Jeff as well. But Mike, a quick thought from you about the interview there with Roberta.
Yeah, absolutely. Congratulations to both of them for this honor. And it really is, sort of the Nobel Prize of robotics. But man, I could have just sat and talked to Roberta for the whole afternoon. What a fun and entertaining conversationalist she is. And, in the arc of her career, she really has influenced so much. And I think we all need to give her a round of applause and thank her for her efforts. I mean, she really has been a warrior for safety, for her entire career. And we're all better as a result of that.
Yeah, no question. And as we talked about in the interview with her, really probably the hardest part is getting everybody there to meet and get on the same page and not have biased input and, selfish personal reasons and agendas, right? So and for her to really get everybody to buy in.
Absolutely.
Is her magic. So again, thanks to Roberta for all that she's done for this industry that we all love. So that's going to do it, folks, for episode 116 of the podcast. Quickly before we go, our Robo Business call for presentations is open. The deadline is June 16th. We're running that show October 18th and 19th at the Santa Clara Convention Center out in California. We'll be focusing on general design and development issues for commercial robots. We'll also be focusing more so on field robotics systems, so any sort of robot that operates outdoors in dynamic environments. We want to hear from you. How are you doing it? Why are you doing it? What are some of the keys to your success? Where is this all going? Again, a lot of fun stuff in the works for Robo Business, October 18th and 19th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. And again, if you came to the Robotics Summit or are aware of the Robotics Summit, it's the same team producing Robo Business now as we did last year as well. So it should be a great event. So go to robobusiness.com. You'll see the form there to enter. Again, you got to enter by June 16th to be considered to speak at Robo Business. So I hope to see you all there. Thanks again to everybody for tuning into the show. New episodes of the Robot Report podcast drop each week. You can find us anywhere you listen to your podcast. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review, tell your friends about us. We really appreciate that. On behalf of Mike Hoitzman and the entire crew, I'm Steve Crow. Thanks, folks, for tuning in. We'll talk to you again soon.